Children have human rights. They're humans.
Every child's first hero is their caregiver.
You see it firsthand, and you really see and feel the impact, not just on the individual that you represent, but also their families and everyone else who gets left behind in their sphere.
We have chosen to support and pay for a system of punishment that causes these intergenerational harms on the children.
The best interests of the child shall be a primary consideration.
Hello, this is Michael Holland. I'm a lawyer at the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office. I'm also on the board of Children of Incarcerated Caregivers. We call ourselves CIC. CIC researches and disseminates information for use by policymakers, legal professionals, and community representatives in the evidence-based creation of policies, laws, and programs supporting children impacted by caregiver incarceration. We're here today to do a podcast in conjunction with the University of Minnesota Human Rights Department that has been approved for continuing legal education credit to promote this mission. Hello, this is Michael Holland. I'm a board member of the Children of Incarcerated Caregivers. We're lucky today to have Barbara Fry with us. Barbara is a lawyer and senior lecturer in the Institute of Global Studies at the University of Minnesota. She's director of the Human Rights Program in the University of Minnesota's College of Liberal Arts, and she's done extensive research in human rights and human rights issues and advocacy. So Barbara, welcome, and how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for inviting me to your podcast.
Yeah, I think we have a great lineup here today of things to talk about. We're going to talk about sentencing on an international stage and how that might relate to us here in Minnesota and in the United States. It should be exciting. I'm excited, Barbara.
Well, great. I'm looking forward to the conversation. I can't say that I know the domestic stuff, so that's your expertise, and I can give you some sense of what the standards are and the international conversation is around the issue of children of incarcerated caregivers, and I hope that's helpful.
It will be helpful for all of us lawyers, judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and the like. I should mention I'm a public defender here in Hennepin County, City of Minneapolis, and Barbara's also on the board of the Children of Incarcerated Caregivers. So, Barbara, let's start here. Do you think that parental incarceration is an international human rights issue, and how so?
Yes, thanks, Mike. It definitely is, especially as it impacts children. So children, of course, have human rights. They're humans. And all of the international human rights documents recognize the rights of every person. And those persons include persons under the age of 18, which is the international standard for what is a child. So the... you know, if you think about it, the children have rights, and their rights, as defined in international law, are, you know, they are appropriate to their particular development. So, you know, very infant children are completely dependent, and as children get more and more independence, their relationship to their own rights changes. But all children under international law have the right to be raised by their parents. And children also have the right to have their views taken into account if they're able to defend their views. And they have the right to personal development and well-being. And, of course, children have the right to non-discrimination. So all these rights are impacted by parental incarceration, and so therefore that issue is one that we have to consider under the standards that have developed in the international field.
Now, so is there a difference in how those standards have developed internationally versus nationally?
Well, internationally, the primary treaty regarding children is the Convention on the Rights of the Child.
When was this developed?
It was apparent after the development of the major treaties, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, that there was a need to address the particular circumstances of children. And children have been recognized always as needing special protection under international law. But the concept of children as rights bearers is something that's fairly modern. And I think that because the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which, as you probably know, Mike, is the a treaty which is universally ratified except for one state, and that state is the United States, and we can talk about that if you want to. But because of the universal ratification of that treaty, the notion of children as rights bearers is now integrated in domestic laws in states all across the globe. So it's not just that children are the property of their parents or the subjects of their parents, but they in and of themselves have their own rights. So that might have not been the domestic norm before the convention, but now it's such a universally accepted set of standards that that is the law now.
If the U.S. hasn't ratified the convention, how can we argue that it's relevant?
Let me tell you that under international law, when a treaty has the level of universal ratification that this one does, and the United States was, of course, involved very central to the drafting of this treaty, and it was fully supported in the United States until it got thrown as a... as a target for partisan differences in the late 90s and early 2000s. So this treaty, even though we haven't ratified it, it is an obligatory norm under international law. The United States could not claim to be a dissenter in this treaty to the extent that it would be exempt from the standards that are part of the treaty.
Okay. And that makes sense. It sounds like it's something that would be persuasive, but not binding.
Exactly. I mean, the United States has actually ratified two protocols to this treaty. One on sex trafficking and one on children in armed conflict. So ironically, we are party to the protocols to the convention, but not to the convention itself. And as I say, that is simply a partisan explanation that there's one misrepresentation that continues to be made in U.S. politics about the convention, which is that it is... an attempt to allow the state to intervene in the parental child relationship, when the treaty is quite explicit that parents have the primary role in the development of their children and guidance. And so basically the real purpose of the convention is to kind of keep the state out of the children's right to develop and to have their own ideas and their own religion. But it's, as many things in U.S. politics, this has been twisted. And so we have this unfortunate situation where the United States is the only country in the world that hasn't ratified this treaty.
And that's relating to parental incarceration. Is that, do I have that right?
Well, I raise it. The Convention on the Rights of the Child speaks to every right that children have.
How does the Convention on the Rights of the Child relate to parental incarceration?
As it relates to parental incarceration, this issue has been, is part of the treaty, specifically Let me see if I can get you specific language on that. The treaty says that in all actions concerning children, whether undertaken by public or private social welfare institution or courts of law, administrative authorities or legislative bodies, the best interests of the child shall be a primary consideration. So that's the central idea behind everything in this treaty, is that the best interests of the child are primary. And that's the same as the United States, right? That's the same standard that you deal with in court.
Yeah. And as I was telling you previously, is that what I do is in juvenile court, I represent children whose parental rights are being terminated in some cases and abridged in others. And when I'm representing the child, the standard is best interest of the children. So that's a practice that our courts are familiar with. And it sounds like on the international stage, that is the standard they use throughout.
Exactly.
Okay, that's good.
Exactly. And so what international law brings to this is that there has been a specific discussion about children with parents in prison. And so there have been rules that have been developed after the convention. In 2011, there is a set of rules called the Bangkok Rules, which were adopted by the UN General Assembly. They're specifically focused on women in prison. So there's a certain gendered focus to these, in the sense that they understand that mothers have a particular role in the upbringing of their children. I think that the gender discussion is an important one that needs to be expanded upon. But what the Bangkok rules say is that any decisions to allow children to stay with their mothers in prison, or what their relationship is with their mothers who are in prison, shall be based on the best interests of the child. So it's, again, a very common sense approach to this. What it's doing is it's foregrounding the responsibility of the state to take into consideration the existence of children and their best interests in relation to all decisions related to the mother who is incarcerated.
That's fascinating. And that makes sense. And so... courts, United States courts, as we talked about, are not bound by international law and the UN's recommendations that they're making and the treaties that we talked about. But are arguments made that, how are arguments made to make U.S. courts consider these guidelines?
Sure. So, the U.S. courts, the Supreme Court, has not accepted the idea that international law, even treaties, which are binding treaties, that it's unless those treaty obligations are enshrined in U.S. statutes or domestic law, they are not considered to be binding in U.S. courts. There has been, since the establishment of the United Nations, very concerted efforts by sort of anti-globalist forces, political forces, to make sure that nothing in the international in international human rights, for instance, is binding on U.S. Cases, unless the U.S. has actually adopted those into U.S. law. So in a lot of cases, the standards with regard to children, for instance, we find in domestic law. There's not a lot of space there between international standards and domestic standards. But more importantly, really, is this sense of the way ideas travel, right? So you think about cases concerning gay rights or women's rights or things like that, that the Supreme Court even has found ways to embrace common sense ideas that exist in international law or that are practiced by other states without suggesting that they're binding at all. So that's the case, you know, I think that we have here is that I think certain judges would be interested in learning what the practice is in other states with regard to incarcerated parents, right? That, you know, for instance, Mike, a lot of states support what are called prison nurseries. So they allow and even suggest it's in the best interest of the child for the child to be in prison with the mother or the, yeah, in these cases, their mothers. The idea is especially infants or if a mother gives birth while she's incarcerated, instead of taking that baby away, allowing the baby to bond with the mother and be in prison, not as a prisoner, but to be able to live with the mother for a certain amount of time. So, you know, it's interesting to learn about these practices and what do these prison nurseries look like. You know, they're not in, you know, as I say, it's hard for us with our image of U.S. prisons to think of having small children in prisons, but prisons look different in different parts of the world. So the role of international law in international practice in U.S. courts tends to be by example rather than judges like embracing these standards as obligatory. They just are, they use them as interpretive. So they look at, you know, if you're looking at, if it's the same language, best interest of the child, you say, well, what do they consider the best interest of the child in Sweden? You know, and we look at that and then we learn from that experience and try and understand what might work well here.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me as a, you know, practicing lawyer. Are there areas, for instance, where I think we talked before we started the podcast about like Granby, Florida, where the Supreme Court has looked at the international law in interpreting how the United States is going to deal with a statute or a situation. Can you think of other examples that might work and talk a little bit about Granby, Florida?
Sure. Yeah. Granby, Florida was the case where the Supreme Court found that that U.S. statutes prohibited minors from being sentenced to life without parole. I mean, before then, there had been a whole series of cases. First, it was outlawing the juvenile executions, right? Executions of individuals for crimes they committed as juveniles. And then then the question is, okay, well, if you can't execute them, if you're using, you know, the moral guidelines that, you know, you can't execute someone for what they did as a minor, then life without parole is sort of a form of torture. And so the Supreme Court did use international law in interpreting the U.S. statutes. There have been other cases around death penalty, gay rights. For instance, in the gay rights cases, the initial U.S. law that prohibited consensual homosexual sex it claimed that was a violation of the laws of human decency all around the globe, and when in fact in Europe and in the international courts there had already been a recognition of the legality and the human right to consensual homosexual sex. And so when I'm trying to remember the name of the case, Mike, caught me by surprise, but when the U.S. finally flipped that, you know, they actually referred to these, to the international standards, saying, you know, that global standards on decency evolve, and that this was recognized as a right. So, you know, there are a fair number of examples. What you find, it's sort of interesting. I mean, when it's at the Supreme Court level, it really depends on the justice, right? And there's been this, as I say, this anti-globalist backlash, where when Supreme Court nominees go through the process of being reviewed by the Senate, it's a classic set of questions that's now asked to make sure that these Supreme Court justices do not embrace any international law obligations unless they've been codified in U.S. law. But on the other hand, there's nothing you can, I mean, justices, as you know, in cases, whether at the Supreme Court level or other levels, there's a lot of interpretation involved in statutes. And if there are practices or standards that exist that help us understand the best interests of the child, judges are able to use that as part of their interpretive discretion.
Yeah, and I think of the Padilla decision and that whole line of cases and how that came about. We had a lot of litigation around that at the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office. In Padilla, the U.S. Supreme Court said that criminal defense attorneys must advise non-citizen clients about the deportation risks of a guilty plea. That whole idea was born out of international law and human rights that would pertain to an individual who is incarcerated in a foreign country, and how that has to be considered. And now it's just standard practice that lawyers advise their client about the immigration consequences of a plea or of what's going on in their particular case.
It's not just standard practice. It's right. It's malpractice if you don't, because exactly. there's a recognition that if you basically don't consider someone's immigration status and they get deported back to a place where they're persecuted, that you know, that's been something you're responsible as the lawyer representing them. So these international standards have a way of coming in and helping us to understand some of the tough calls that we have here. And I think, you know, for a long time, U.S. judges were not really thinking about children when they were sentencing someone. Maybe if it was a female, I mean, you know better than I, but maybe if they found out that she was a mother, they would be more concerned. But certainly with male defendants, I'm guessing that rarely came up. And yet there's now this really series of international recommendations that not only suggest that that their role as parents should be taken into consideration and the best interests of the child should be taken into consideration, but also if the person is incarcerated, that the state has to have reasonable visitation that isn't harmful for the child, that if there are recommendations that the parents be incarcerated close to where the child lives so that they can visit. You know, there's a whole series of judgments that flow from this fundamental principle that the best interests of the child have to be considered in this whole process.
And that relates to what a practitioner like myself would do. Do you think it's important that practitioners and judges consider it, but practitioners bring it up that human rights is a important aspect of sentencing when it comes to incarcerated parents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that it's I think it's incredibly important, and we're seeing the impacts through the research that the Children of Incarcerated Caregivers has done. You know, we've seen the impacts on children, the negative impacts on children of everything from the arrest scene, how arrests are handled in front of children, to the their pretrial detention, to the sentencing decision and where they're placed in prisons and how far they are from their children. And it's just an understanding that we need to think sort of at the intersections, not just that this person is an individual who may have committed a crime and it may have had an impact on a victim or a set of victims, but also to think about the broader implications of what that sentencing will do to their family and the people who depend on them. And I think we've seen this even in just imagine in the COVID era, you know, of where we've all been reduced to take care of our own in such small settings. And if a parent gets taken out of that situation, or maybe, you know, that it has huge repercussions on the child and the rights of the child.
Yeah, and I think of it in a sense of the ripple effect of it. You know, if you incarcerate a parent and take that support away from a child, sometimes that is so bad for the child that it perpetuates the lawless behavior in a new generation, and it makes it more difficult, and so moral issues are implicated as well.
Right.
So
Mike, I just wanted to I was looking here at the list of regions and states that are already requiring, or well, certainly encouraging, if not requiring, states to consider parental status at sentencing. So in South Africa, the court has said that the court has to consider parental status at sentencing. In Australia, the legislature has required courts to take it into consideration. And then in various regions, in Europe, the Council of Europe encourages states to consider parental status. The African Charter encourages states to consider non-custodial punishments for mothers. And the European Parliament has also encouraged alternatives to prison for mothers. So this is already happening in courts around the world. And I have no doubt that it's beginning to happen in courts in the United States, but I think that prosecutors and judges, as well as defense attorneys, just need to recognize that this is a critical piece of data. Someone else's rights are implicated in this sentencing process.
And that's fascinating. It's interesting to hear of all those places that are considering these things. And sometimes, as progressive as we think we are in the United States, sometimes we're a little bit behind. People don't realize that.
Well, certainly in, you know, incarceration and mass incarceration issues, the United States has, you know, there's only less than 10% of prisoners around the world are women, right, to start out. But a huge number of those are in the United States to begin with. So our industry of imprisonment, you know, is unlike anywhere else in the world. I mean, of course, there we have different kind of imprisonment in China and North Korea, where you have prison labor camps, and incarcerating whole populations of people. But in straight criminal justice terms, what the United States does sets an important pattern, but we can also learn from other countries that may not have as big a prison population, but are thinking through practical ways to balance the rights of defendants and their families with the state security needs, and whether, you know, maybe this is just another issue that we need to think of that makes us rethink the problems with the criminal justice system and a system of incarceration in the United States.
So, Barbara, in wrapping this thing up, we've been talking now for almost a half an hour, and it's been very interesting. There's something about me you didn't know, is that I was given a magic wand. Did you know that?
No, impressive. Yep,
I was given a magic wand, but it's a very narrow magic wand. It is a magic wand that deals with human rights and how the courts would deal with incarcerated caregivers. And I'm giving that wand to you because you are an expert in the field, and I think you could use it way better than I could. So I've handed it over to you now, and I'd like to hear what you're going to do with this wand. What progress would you like to see the courts make here in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that we even need international law in figuring out how to use that wand. I just think as a society, our moral obligation needs to put children at the center of the decisions that we make publicly. You know, we think of children in schools, and we're going through this whole process of how to educate children and how to deal with their needs. These are critical members of our society. And if we began to take children in consideration, you know, we do, you know, environmental reporting now ahead of time, making public decisions. If we could make decisions that about how are our public decisions impacting our children, not just on sentencing guidelines, but in public policy, I think that would be an excellent shift. And where we began to, whether it be, you know, gun violence or hunger or any of the social problems we're addressing, that if we as a society and as judges always thought of the children first and basically asked that question anytime we make decisions on behalf of the government, I think we're going to end up with a far more just and happy society.
That's great. I feel vindicated in giving you that magic wand. Well said, Barbara. Again, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. This has been great. I know I'm smarter and a better lawyer for listening to the words that you just said, and I hope everyone found it exhilarating and as interesting as I did.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for asking, and thanks for listening.
All right. Well, take care now, and be safe and stay warm.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this Continuing Legal Education podcast hosted by me, Michael Holland, with Children of Incarcerated Caregivers. Our episodes contain original music by David Smith, our podcast producer. If you intend to request credit for this CLE and any of our other installments, please enter your name and contact information at the link in the description. You can find more about our organization and access the materials that correspond to these episodes, including federal and state sentencing checklists, online at cicmn.org.